Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Thank you for joining us. I just spoke with William Marotti about his new book, Money, Trains, and Guillotines, Art and Revolution in 1960s Japan, and Duke University Press published this book in 2013. Now, you will definitely find money, you will find trains, and you will find guillotines in this book. It's a really thoughtful exploration, and thoughtful both in terms of its structure and its narrative architecture, as well as the arguments that it's making within that structure and within that architecture about the emergence of a particular mode of practice by a group of people that we might retrospectively identify as artists, but who didn't all self-identify in that way, in the context of a rising political consciousness in occupied Japan in the 1960s and in some parts of the story in the 1950s. So this is a book that really interestingly brings together elements of cultural history, elements of political history, close reading of texts, and a really sensitive accounting of artistic practice into a story that works on several levels of perspective. So the story unfolds by holding close this particular paradigmatic work, the work of not a counterfeiting, but a kind of simulacrum of 1,000 yen notes, money notes, currency, by this artist, Akasagawa Genpei, and taking that as a focal point from which to expand and then go in closer, switch our angle, look at it in a different way, look at it from a different perspective, and understand how it was possible for this artistic work to emerge, how it had many, many kinds of ramifications within its larger context, and how this might tell us a story about not only 1960s Japan and the modes and practices of political activism in places that we might not ordinarily look for them, but also about what different and innovative modes of cultural history might look like if we don't necessarily hew to a straightforwardly chronological narrative of a story, but if instead we use and play with chronology as a way to open up different kinds of perspectives on events, on moments, and on modes of practice. So it's a really interesting story full of lots and lots of really close readings of objects as well as texts, accounts of different forms of practice, including gatherings, including music, including essays and writing and articles. We only barely scratched the surface of this really fascinating book, and I recommend it to you, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with William Marotti about his book, Money, Trains, and Guillotines, Art and Revolution in 1960s Japan. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, and thank you so much for spending the time to talk with me today about what's a very beautiful and very inspiring new book.
Thank you so much, Carla. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, of course. So could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to, if you can think back to what inspired you to come to the field of modern Japanese history and modern Japanese history with an eye to an interest in political and artistic expression in particular, what brought you to this general field?
Boy, you know, to be honest about sort of the narrative that leads me to this point, I have to say it's not a sort of straight line kind of a deal, and maybe it has something to do with how I approach history as well, with the sort of notion about the importance of contingency. There's a lot of contingent elements. I had an encounter in college with some fairly funky aspects of Japanese cultural production when as a undergraduate at the University of Michigan, I saw a performance by the Butoh troupe, Sankai Juku, as well as the island drumming group from Sadagashima, Kodo. That together with some literature and translation classes kind of had stuck with me for a while. But I graduated college and was working in a law firm and for several years and realized I like doing research, but I rather preferred doing research that I had was deciding what it would be. Thought about going back to school. Ended up thinking about China. I'd had a lot more courses China related. I was a Southeast Asian history major in college, and then the Tiananmen Square thing happened, and basically knowing myself, I thought, you know, I'm going to get myself into serious trouble heading in this direction, and thought back to those early encounters, and having decided to go back to school, had to learn Japanese and did the 1 year intensive program at Cornell Falcon, and then headed to the University of Chicago the next year. As far as the topic, the specific topic of this book, which was my dissertation work, that also sort of harked back to this earlier moment. I was doing coursework and starting to think ahead about what topics to possibly explore for a dissertation. And one professor had suggested something about the maybe looking at an interwar philosophy and science and materialism group with Yui Butsudon Kenkyukai, and it was interesting to me, but I was looking ahead to many long hours with these giant gray journals and a certain lack of excitement and fun, and was sitting around my apartment and looked across the way to a bookshelf and saw a book on Buto and walked over and was sort of flipping through it. And it had a picture of the Anpo protests and just sort of casually mentioned, well, you know, when Buto originates, this is going on. And there's also lots of other funky forms of cultural production happening. I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder if these two things are related in any way by something other than propinquity, where you line the two things up and say, hey, look. And I went careening through the library stacks and found a piece on the Thousand Yen incident in a period English language journal called Concerned Theater Japan, and began looking from that point onward, and never turned back. Just got more and more interesting, no matter which direction I was looking in.
That's actually really interesting that you started off by being by somebody suggesting that you look at issues of science and materialism, even if you didn't go in that direction, because it's really one of the things that struck me in reading the chapters of the book, and we'll get here in time in the course of our conversation, is how important the language of science or the language of a kind of scientism and a language of a kind of a concern with materiality and embodiment really run through a lot of the work that comes up as being particularly emblematic of the kinds of transformations that you're talking about.
I think there's probably parallels and differences. I mean, with someone like Tosaka Jin, who was a big part of that group, you know, on the one hand, a very serious approach to science and trying to find the adequate critical language for addressing current problems. On the other hand, the interwar group also basically had to dissimulate the fact that they were taking Marx and Marxism very seriously, and trying not to instantly end up in prison, though many of them did end up there and some ended up dying there. But no one was killing these artists. They're just arresting and harassing them at the time.
So you've already mentioned a little bit of the kind of an introduction to what the book is about, and just kind of very briefly, my little one sentence short version The book, for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to see the book, it maps out a kind of ecology of politics, culture, and avant-garde artistic production in post-war Japan. And as I mentioned earlier, it's also quite beautiful as an object itself. And it's a very, it's just a really inspiring example of book design as well. So it's just a kind of a beautiful object to look through, as well as being a really fascinating story. Now, we'll get into the details of the parts of the book and the chapters in a moment. But before we get there, you've mentioned that this started out as a project in its first phase of life that was your dissertation. So can you talk a little bit about that transition and really any part of the transition from dissertation to book that you feel was particularly notable, if there were any major transformations in either the structure of the work and or the way you were thinking about and conceptualizing it? Any part of that transformation that you'd like to talk about, I'd love to know if there was anything like that.
Sure. And maybe I should talk about two points, one being the transition from the research project to the dissertation, and then again from the dissertation towards the book.
Sure.
This is both important moments. One, when I originally was doing this project, I initially conceived of it as looking at all forms of sort of radical cultural production in the 60s. And so I was doing research and even interviewing people involved in theater and dance and music and all kinds of forms of art and cultural production. But I eventually figured out that I was on my way to the 5,000 word dissertation or 5,000 page dissertation, probably a divorce, and God knows what else. And fortunately, I was in the process. I was getting a sense that there was a kind of discrete thing centered on the artist of the Yomiuri Independent, and so I focused in on that for the dissertation. So that was one step. The second step, though, was of course in its afterlife after the dissertation. I immediately after graduation, I spent 2 years at New York University's ICAS Center for they were doing a project on the Cold War as global history, and it was a very intensive assignment. I was the Wilson postdoc there and was there for 2 years, and there were weekly presentations, and there was this remarkable opportunity to engage with scholars working on the Cold War all over the world. And sort of on the basis of that, I got a little bit more up to speed with thinking about issues of global history, issues of comparability, and issues about the 60s. I ended up creating a 1960s course, a global course at that time. And so one of the things I wanted to do when revising this book, and it's heavily revised for the book, was to deal more adequately with this international dimension. And the other part was sort of a kind of organic outgrowth of research, which was as I was reviewing the content and looking a little more seriously at the art trial that takes center stage in the first part of the three-part book, where Akasegawa Genpei, the artist, is prosecuted for the crime of money imitation. For making monochrome copies of the Thousand Yen Note, I got very interested in the constitutional law questions that were arising in the context of the post-war constitution, in the context of purportedly freedoms of expression that were nonetheless constantly run roughshod over, and the strange preservation of really a pre-war censorship. Legal censorship apparatus, not the direct kinds of censorship of the pre-war exactly, but rather the some of the law and some of the legal findings were still retained. And this interested me. And I ended up going back to constitutional debates during the crafting and the shaping of the post-war constitution, the Diet debates, and looking very seriously at how this post-war constitution was structured. And in the end, I ended up with an argument about the post-war emperor system and about policing that was grounded in this legal and constitutional framework, which I think in the end I found pretty satisfactory. But at the time, it was a moment of sort of concern, you know, when you're heading in a direction, you're not quite sure if you're wasting your time or not. Mm-hmm. You seem to feel like you're out on a limb. This was one of those moments, because it was this giant argument that was bulging forth in the middle of an already long chapter. It ends up being chapter two of the book. Mm. Perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Oh no, this is actually fine. And you just mentioned, you were just talking about the argument, right? You're sort of a major argument that you were trying to make. Shortly ago, when we were talking before we actually started the interview, you mentioned that the cover of the book actually concretizes in some way the argument that you were trying to make in the book as a whole. So maybe this is a good way to get into the book itself and the body of the book. Can you talk a little bit about this aspect of the cover and its distillation of the argument? And I'm actually fascinated to hear about this.
Certainly. I've been carrying around these two images for a while, and really knew that I wanted to have them be the focal point of the cover. One was the bottom image, the black and white image. It's a shot of protesters out in front of the Diet in June of 1960 during the AMPO protest, the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty renewal and revision protests. It's shot by the photographer Ishikoro Kenji, and he's done something very interesting here. He's shot it with a kind of fisheye lens, and he's left a great deal of negative space above the Diet. And it's also, because it's fisheye, it's taken some of the banners and things and sort of had them angling inward to some sort of strange vanishing point. I've of course gratuitously made use of all that lovely negative space by slapping the title into it. I think it's really interesting, because this was a photographer who, at the time, he was spending a lot of time photographing not just the protesters, but also the young men who are serving in the police forces. And shots of them sleeping and other things. And also shooting photos of some of the artists and the art that was happening at the time. And he hadn't quite put this together in his head, but in any event, what he captures in the photo, I think, is a kind of sense of anxiety about the whole thing. And I kind of make the argument that sort of compositionally, what he's capturing is a sense of the tension, or even the inadequacy of the protest and its focus on the Diet itself as not a complete picture, leaving all that negative space above it. It's a perspective that I kind of agree with. In a sense, this was, an attempt to get the Diet to recognize the will of the protesters, their demonstration of sincerity and numbers and so forth. It, of course, had given rise to the Prime Minister with his famous line about we're just hearing the noise right now, but I'm going to listen to the voiceless voices. You know, he's anticipating Nixon by about a decade. silent majority. There's a sense in which this protest is on the one hand sort of supplicatory. It requires the Diet to sort of see visually the protest and to recognize and to accord with their wishes and then to do the right thing, which of course doesn't happen. And the other problem, though it's not, it doesn't happen during the composition, obviously, of the photo itself, but maybe speaks again to the problem of this form of protest in the context of single party rule and the close relation of the United States and Japan at that time. The protests themselves, after they failed to prevent the security treaties renewal, disappear very quickly. And this is a problem actually that's taken up by some of the artists. I write about this. The problem of the disappearance of overt political opposition and its vulnerability essentially to arguments that proceed through a kind of soft appeal to income doubling and so forth, and sort of gentle conciliation. So I feel is sort of all floating around with that image, and that's from 1960. The top image is an artwork, a postcard artwork by Akasagawa Genpei, one of the artists who I maybe most centrally feature in the book. And this is related to the 1970 protests against the renewal 10 years later of the security treaty. And it's similar and notably different from the one below. We have unarmed protesters replaced by helmeted and armed protesters. And we have the Diet building replaced not by the 10,000 yen note. It's not the 1,000 yen note because by that time the older B series 1,000 yen note that Akasagawa had used as the subject of his artwork had been replaced. It was just Ito Hirobumi at the time. The 10,000 yen note, the Ichiman note had gotten Prince Shotoku. So to maintain sort of the target on archaic imperial authority, he switches to the 10,000 yen note. And we have a joke. A joke is constructed with these Venn diagrams. And it's a joke that comprises his argument about art's role in this protest. So on the left-hand side, we have a hand of a protester holding a rock, mm-hmm. the kanji for rock below it. And on the right, a wrapped art objet, which is one of the, and these wrapped works were one of the things that Akasagawa worked on during the 60s. And at the overlap or the intersection of these two circles, we have a canon. And of course, if you take the character for rock and the character for rapping and put them together, you get the character for canon. So we have the canon formed at their intersection, which fires and makes a big kaboom or dokang on the 10,000 yen note. And this artwork was actually sent to political prisoners. Akasagawa and a younger friend were engaged in sending these to people who were imprisoned, and it was a kind of message of hope to who might have been losing their hope. But it's also in its revision of the formulation of 1960, it sort of captures this artist's own perspective on what those changes were and art's role in it. And so taken together, the two photos provide a kind of argument of appraises about my argument about how the decade works and art's role in this politics.
Great, thank you so much. Now, as we sort of move from the cover of the book into the inner chapters, you mentioned early on in the book that you made a very deliberate choice about structuring it one way and not another way. So even though there's a chronology right at the beginning or sort of toward the beginning of the book to orient readers who really are looking for or need that kind of foundation for understanding, you know, what comes after what and then what comes next, you've chosen instead to organize the narrative thematically. So you have the book, the eight chapters of the book broken up into three parts, each of which looks carefully at one aspect and an important aspect or set of aspects that are related to these larger arguments that you just laid out when talking about the cover. So can you talk a little bit about that choice as we get into the chapters themselves? Why Sure. Why did you choose to structure it the way you did, and how does that speak to or help help readers or listeners understand the way that the structure is shaping the larger argument that you're making?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Of course, the chronology is there to provide a kind of a lifeline as events hop around within the book. But essentially, the structure has something to do with my sense of, on the one hand, our what's familiar to us and what's often expected with histories and our bias towards a kind of simple linear narrative against really the experience of history and the way in which that history marks and interacts the present and is a dimension of the present. So it's an argument about how to write cultural history, and I hope in demonstrating what this kind of a structure can then yield, it's an argument in favor of these kind of flexible approaches. But essentially, I as an exercise in cultural history, I'm asking questions about historically situated meaning at the time, and for the activities of principally of some artists who are doing some fairly strange and odd things. But once you start asking those questions about what seems to be a fairly small, narrow, and oddball group, you find yourself very quickly, if you don't stop at institutional or disciplinary borders, asking some very serious and broad questions about things like how does post-war policing work? What is the continuing role of the experience of the occupation? How does the post-war constitution work, and so forth? And by taking sort of three different parts that have particular kinds of focus, I get a different set of details that then are sort of expanded on in the next section, and we get a sort of deepening of our understanding of this moment of particularly of the early 60s in Japan, and it's something that I think I would have travestied kind of erased if this had just been a very simple and straightforward exercise and chronological narrative. Mm-hmm. It would have involved a kind of denial of the presentness of history in these moments.
It really would have been a very different kind of story if you had ordered it chronologically, because one of the things that happens here, so we've got for listeners, just to let everybody know as we get into these details here, the book is organized into three parts. Part one really looks at different aspects of the prosecution of this artist who we will follow through the rest of the book, or who we will see coming up through the rest of the book. This is Akasegawa Genpei, who you've mentioned, for his production of single-sided monochrome prints of the 1,000 yen note. Part two kind of opens out and looks at, or kind of situates him within the larger context of the avant-garde and the Yomiuri Independent and this group of artists who are doing sort of in various ways exploring how to use their practice and their work in relation to a kind of political activism and a political protest in which that speaks to the larger context in which they're living. And then in the third part of the book, the chapters then also shift a kind of perspective and a focus to, again, come back to these artists and come back to Akasegawa in particular by looking at how they themselves are conceptualizing and are articulating their practices in their work. So it's a story that rather than proceeding in chronological or kind of unfolding in a chronological way, it asks us to take the same object and look at it from successively very different kinds of perspectives, and thus I think gives us a very different way to look at and envision not only that object but also to experience what a plurality of vision feels like and looks like as a reader. And I don't think that would have been able to happen if you had structured it chronologically. So just as a reader, that's my perspective on that.
No, I think that's fair. Should I talk a little bit more about sort of how the different parts work, or to get into that?
Let's actually do that by getting into it. So there are eight wonderful chapters. We won't be able to get into each one of them, but I think we'll be most effective in trying to proceed through the argument as you develop it in as many of them as we can. So we've already talked a little bit about Akasegawa. You talk about the nature of the project, what brings him to this project in which he's producing these, again, single-sided, so not double-sided, monochrome prints of the 1,000 yen note at the beginning. You talk a little bit about how his work came to the attention of state agents. Now, one of the things that comes up early in the book, though, in the first chapter or two, that's really important to situating what he's doing within a larger context, not just politically, but also conceptually, is this way of understanding his practice within this larger set of discourses around imitation versus counterfeiting, mozo versus gizo. So can you, and then you also render that in the book as an issue of simulacra versus simulation. So that might be, I think, a really good place from which to open out. Can you talk a little bit about his work, what he's doing in the context of those issues, and then we can kind of open up and proceed with the story from there.
Sure. And may just say at the beginning too, before people run away from the interview tape with a sense of this incredibly tangled and horrible book. It's sort of like, you know, I did my best to sort of guide people with providing not just an introduction that lays out the structure of the book and why it works in the way it does, but also short introductions for each of the three sections that sort of give an overview of how the argument works. So returning to your question, the issue with Akasegawa and in this first section of the book, it sort of begins really with what perhaps would be some slightly obvious or even naive questions. One being, why is this artist making monochrome copies of the 1,000 yen note, and the other one being, why is the state energetically going after this artist for, you know, these works that, you know, are pretty awful and as attempts at counterfeiting, if you would. Mm-hmm. But it opens into this question about perception and about a critical approach to the everyday. And that's sort of where this distinction that I make between counterfeiting or simulation, if you will, and imitation or imperfect imitation, intentionally imperfect imitation, such as Akasegawa's works, which are then covered with this 1895 oddball statute about money imitation, gives the state this broad authority to criminalize these things that can't really be conceived of as potential counterfeits, but more kind of I even call it a kind of blasphemy, an attack on money. And it's an attack at the moment that the state is absolutely hinging its legitimacy on the power of money and wealth and the burgeoning economy or the promises of all these things, to diffuse protest and opposition to both the single party rule and to the state's engagement of Japan in the midst of America's cold and hot wars in Asia. So what's going on with Akasegawa's work is if he just make a copy of money, say, you know, counterfeit, trying to make as identical a thing as possible. And I talk about this as a simulation, as something that's, it's not questioning or struggling with or working against the ways in which money itself is defined. It's sort of piggybacking on it and taking advantage of it. You can imagine crises being caused by these things nonetheless. I mean, this, you know, counterfeiting has been used as a weapon against different states at different times. And actually, at the time that Akasegawa was doing his work, in part, he was trading on the power of the 1,000-yen note at the moment, which was under assault from a very serious counterfeiting ring that was producing counterfeits that really only bank officials could tell apart from real notes. And the newspapers were publishing these lists of serial numbers for the counterfeit notes, and people were already in the position where they were looking at the 1,000-yen notes with increased scrutiny. And Akasegawa took advantage of those and used some of the techniques that artists are very good at using to ask questions about images and function and practice. And basically where he's, it begins in a kind of playful way and exploratory way and sort of expands out and then gets another life as it's engaged with by the police and by the media itself. And so we have this interesting interplay between moments of artistic practice and moments of kind of theorizing and re-theorizing and reorientation of that practice. Mm-hmm. But anyway, sort of, these are all questions that you get out of beginning with this one art work that has the state involvement, I'm using it to lead into starting to unfold this the whole range of artistic and critical practice that this thing is a piece of.
Right, and let's actually start moving to that. And so you in. Just for the sake of listeners who haven't yet had a chance to see the book, this early first part of the book not only opens up and provides a really detailed account of the project, of what brought him to this kind of form of critique in the first place, you also give us a really useful background here on this larger social and political context that's of the Allied occupation of Japan and the ways that the occupation is actually interested in preserving the figure of the emperor as this symbolic, powerful force that also serves to reify and provide a powerful foothold, reify the power of and provide access to power by and for the occupation forces. And so you're taking us through this story that this is the larger set of issues that this project in Counterfeiting Currency is ultimately responding to and embedded in. And you talk in detail in this first part of the book about the ways that this project of counterfeiting money, but actually, again, not counterfeiting, right? It's explicitly imitating money, is a form of critique that's then situated within the larger forms of critique that this artist is producing, including really fascinating written pieces on spying and spy rules, including really interesting material objects, and including really kind of fascinating collage work. And in particular, I'm thinking of this project, The Ambiguous Ocean. So ultimately, we get this picture at the end of the day, as you put it here, of currency being identified by this artist with, as you put it, the unconscious domination underwritten by state authority and based on the imposed identification of state-printed currency as real. So early on in the book, what we have here is a laying out of not just what the project was, where it's coming from, but really what the stakes are as well of doing this kind of project and why someone would have chosen this particular medium to affect the particular kind of critique and engagement that he was choosing to invoke. So as we move to the second part of the book, here we open out and understand Akasegawa within this larger context of artists that he is meeting, that he's engaged with, and that are part of this larger project of sort of critically engaging the sort of political issues that are not being engaged anymore, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, by protesters after the Anpo demonstrations. Okay, so this part of the book, part two, locates us in the world of the Yomiuri Independent and the Yomiuri Anpan. So can you talk a little bit for listeners about what is the Yomiuri Independent and how do we understand Akasegawa as part of this? And can you talk just a little bit about this group?
Sure. So And the history of this book also provides yet this exhibition provides yet another moment in which the narrative ends up starting at the 60s and then going back to the occupation and then heading forward again. The reason being that this art comes out of this general fervent of avant-garde production that's centered on the yearly Yomiuri Independent exhibition in Tokyo that's held at the Tokyo Municipal Museum of Art what I'm essentially narrating at the time near the time that Akasegawa was does the Unknown project takes off is there's a rise of mostly a new generation of artists who are they're coming some of them have engaged with things like socialist realism or other art forms in the 50s and are heading away from that and into a kind of junk art there's a number points of stimulation for this work, but quite frankly, there's a lot of local one-upsmanship and playfulness. And junk art's handy, you know, you can get, you know, you're working with garbage, so it's not that expensive if you don't have much money. And these exhibitions that they're using as to display these works, works which by and large are thrown out after the exhibition, is a non-juried exhibition. This is important. You for a nominal fee, you get exhibition space and you can put up whatever. but asking the question of sort of where this art exhibition came from, and particularly an art exhibition sponsored by, you know, a fairly conservative newspaper, the Yomiuri, leads back to issues from the early days of the occupation, where newspapers like the Yomiuri were able to dissimulate recent history. On the one hand, history of war boosterism, the Yomiuri had been preeminent on that account, and also a history of union busting, where a fairly radical union at the Yomiuri early on is first encouraged by the occupation authorities, and then finally reined in and fairly well stepped on. But the person who came up with this exhibition idea, it turns out, is someone who had connections to pre-war and interwar and wartime surrealism, and who was apparently involved in some of these strike struggles and was let go for a little while and came back in the Cultural Bureau. And he, a guy named Kaido Hideo, and he was engaged in some of these efforts by the newspaper to do these cultural sponsorships of you know, famous artworks and such things. And he was able to use this position to argue in favor of doing an independent exhibition, one that was non-juried. Now, there was a JCP-connected independent, the Nihon Independent, that was already in progress, and actually he also titled his exhibition Nihon Independent, which makes for a little confusion and struggle. But his goal was, he was hoping that somehow by having an open and non-juried space that he could lead or help facilitate the development of a free and democratic and healthy art within Japan, and you know, that it needed to be not attached to a political party, not attached to a particular viewpoint, but just free and out there. And he got this thing going, and it went on for a number of years, and he's quite close with the surrealist artist and critic Takeuchi Shuzo, and they're discussing, oh gosh, this is not really working out very well, and they decide, let's let it putter along. And in the late 50s, kind of fairly suddenly, a number of these younger artists start to find it to be a conducive space to do something new. And that's where some of the playful, odd art of objects, of objet, of installations, and so forth come from. And part of the book's argument is then that this playful art focused on the detritus of the expanding economy and the everyday world ends up generating, sort of out of its own non-discursive forms, a focus and an attention on the everyday world itself. Maybe I should pause here for a second.
No, this is great. I mean, I think, absolutely. And that's one of the things that's so fascinating about this part of the book, is that after taking us through the genesis of this independent and its roots ultimately in this concern with, among other things, a labor struggle and a concern by artists that the kinds of activism, the kinds of protests that had been happening are now being closed down by, in the context of what you call a Monty Hall moment of post-war Japanese politics, where the state is actually taking advantage of economic expansion to kind of position itself in such a way that it's closing off the kinds of protests that I think a lot of these artists, as you describe in the book, feel are healthy and necessary, they're finding other ways to do this by focusing on the everyday and bringing their art into contexts where you don't otherwise or hadn't otherwise experienced this kind of disruption of the everyday. So it becomes a form of practice as protest in a really interesting way. And you've already mentioned some instantiations of that in this junk art. There are some fascinating examples in chapter 5 in particular. I'll just mention for listeners of happenings of lots of different individual artists who are concerned with corporeality, who are exploring the role and the presence of the body in disrupting the everyday. There's also a really wonderful account of the music group who are experimenting with ideas of improvisation and automatism and automatic writing and using poetry and music to try to affect these kinds of changes. So after all of this, we get to the guillotines, which I have to ask you about because this is it begins the book and it's one of the most fascinating cases.
Before we get to that, could I just say just something really quickly about sort of the role of the everyday here and the role of looking at these artists?
Because
very quickly. So I have an argument here in this section about how the state after AMPO is using the economic expansion, using it sort of moving in front of and championing and using as alibi the economic expansion to depoliticize people. And it's using an economic expansion that could not be more political. There's you know, tech transfers and there's money coming through Japan from both of the Asian hot wars and all sorts of things. But you know, refrigerators don't show up with like pictures of carnage on them. So it's these things are the way the political legitimacy is working. It's working through an apparently unproblematic everyday world. And in part, it has to do with where artists are at and this international moment in art too, that allows them to have a sort of heightened kind of scrutiny and start to ask questions about the role of this everyday world in depoliticizing people, that ends up putting artists out in front in recognizing what I argue then have become sort of key issues for 60s politics.
Great. Yes. Thank you. And this actually, this brings us, I think, really nicely into the last part of the book in part 3, where we see these concerns being manifest in a different kind of setting. Part 3 of the book consists of 3 chapters that each look closely at how the artists themselves are conceptualizing, as I mentioned before, and writing about and sort of making articulate the practices and their work. Now, chapter 6 looks specifically at a couple of cases of this, which are very striking and seem, at least from the narrative of the book, to be very powerful and very important moments in which some of these ideas and some of these practices are crystallized in terms of an effort to conceptualize the everyday as a space of political activism. One of the examples, which is really interesting, was an attempt or a failed plan from late 1962 and 1963 to erect a giant guillotine in the Imperial Plaza. So can you talk a little bit about that and maybe as a way to open up into the larger concerns of this part of the book?
So it was an art incident that never happened, but yet nonetheless is somewhat transformative. In late 1960, mm-hmm. early 1961, in the Central Review Journal, there's a short story published by Fukuzawa Shichiro that has a dream sequence in which the imperial family is executed, is beheaded, and there's also a lot of fairly raunchy and aggressive humor at their expense. And one of the ramifications of this is that a rightist group sends a young assassin to the house of the publisher, Shimonaka Hoji, he's out. So the assassin stabs the maid to death and stabs his wife, who survives. And in the end, the publisher comes out, Shimonaka comes out, and apologizes very deeply and sincerely for having offended anyone. And this is effectively the resumption of what had been called the chrysanthemum taboo against being critical about the emperor. And there were lots of reactions to this, but one set was from a couple artists, Imaizumi Yoshihiko and Nakanishi Natsuyuki, who were already disturbed by the disappearance of activism and overt opposition after Ampo, and were quite horrified at this reaction, and they started having very serious conversations about the feasibility of making a kind of giant art guillotine, erecting it in the Imperial Plaza. And they had a number of versions of this. One, the kind of threshing machine with pickaxes and spades, sort of the implements of labor. Another one that was going to be all glass, so that if it, you know, was used, the whole thing would just kind of explode into shards. And of course they couldn't do this, but it was less about sort of, hey, let's actualize the fantasy sequence from this short story, and rather it was a kind of a symbolic attack on an imperial institution that itself was affected because of its symbolic status. I mean, part of this is an argument in the book about how policing and how the imperial institution works as a kind of alibi for paternalistic state authority post-war that allows the state to then run across what should be clear lines, constitutional lines about freedom of expression and other aspects. It sort of has the alibi of the presence of the emperor to do these things. So the equipment plan is the title of a piece where Imaizumi, having failed in actually realizing this thing, writes up the plan, and it becomes one ingredient for what becomes later a round table that takes up this failed plan and also takes up this other strange experiment on the Yamanote sort of oval line around central Tokyo that actually is carried out by artists like Nakanishi and some others. The artists, having had one realized event and one failed event, talk about art and effectivity and making a difference, and come up and develop this discourse of direct action, Chokusetsu Kodo, that revisits touchstones of you know, anarchist direct action, but also provides a kind of artistic spin on it, I guess, how to possibly take some of their practice coming out of art to then mobilize in some way that'll be politically effective.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, as we, I don't want to keep you for 2 hours, so I'm going to distill a little bit of what's going on in these final chapters as we come to what's going to be the conclusion of our conversation. But I just want to at least take us through briefly what's happening in Chapter 7 and Chapter 8. Now, in these parts of the book, our story about Akasagawa is coming full circle now. So we opened up with a discussion of what his project was, understood that over the course of the book within an increasingly wider or differently focused context in which he was working, and from which a project like the currency project emerged and made sense as a kind of practice that was actually about much more than potentially, you know, creating these objects just for their own sake as an art piece. We come here in chapter 7 and in chapter 8 back to his own statements and successive statements and successive understandings of his own work and of sort of how he is dealing with the ramifications of that work in its engagement with the state and with the consequences that he's being faced with in the prosecution and the aftermath of the prosecution for himself. So do you want to just take a couple of moments to talk a little bit about what's happening in chapter 7, Naming the Real? I mean, here, this chapter looks closely at his article called Theses on Capital Realism from 1964, and this is his reply to police interrogations and to a newspaper article about this case that actually gave a really distorted sense of the nature and the events surrounding his work. And so if there's anything about this chapter in particular that you feel is especially important to the kind of argument that you're making here, please, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. So the whole of chapter 3 is an attempt at a kind of micro history to really look at how politics happens, how you get this interplay between practice and these moments of theorization, because we have such kind of remarkable documentation on this one group. We can kind of see them evolving different moments of theorization in relation to the practice. So chapter 7, Akasegawa had his police interrogations travestied in the press, and he comes back with this very extensive statement. And I look at it, and I contextualize it in terms of what he's been doing for the past year or so, in terms of his own artistic works. And I end up making an argument about how, in fact, the art group High Red Center that he's one part of is actually trying to actualize this notion of artistic direct action. And this is the moment where he really puts a name to it. He argues in favor of a kind of critical practice of what he calls capitalist realism. If socialist realism is a kind of hopeful depiction of the reality of people power and the ultimate triumph of the workers or so forth, capitalist realism is an attempt, it's also a realism, it's an attempt to depict how capitalism itself works, how the state works in conjunction with it. This is where the assault on money comes from, and it's an attempt to formulate an art practice, or I should say a practice. High Red Center doesn't use the word art. Practice adequate to having art fulfill its most serious function, which is to sort of explore and depict how things are actually working, and to do it at a kind of a level of appearances where the unproblematic appearance of things that go unthought of is interrogated as the very scene for a kind of hidden domination. That's sort of the critical import of this practice. And so we have Akasegawa's works and dialogue with the works, his writings, as they sort of slowly, focus this, the sort of, implicit elements of his practice into this articulate, statement that's nonetheless fairly wacky.
Now, as we come to the close of the book, chapter 8 looks at his response to his indictment on November 1st, 1965, and then the epilogue actually takes us into a kind of conclusion of this story. And it's actually very funny. It's very touching, but also very amusing. So could you maybe bring us to a conclusion before we really conclude by saying a little bit about what happens to him after his indictment? Sort of where does the story leave him, and where does it leave us in our relationship to him?
I mean, I guess maybe I should say in general, you know, one of the concerns that some people have had with this book is that, you know, perhaps I'm giving too much agency to the state. And I do make kind of snide notes about the state as a great appreciator or aficionado of this art. But the argument the book has to do with the way in which the artists are working against a kind of what I call policing following Jacques Rancière, the way in which the everyday world itself is working against political opposition and the state's investments in it. And so we get it in this third section, we eventually get the state intervening with the Kasagawa, but it's kind of batting cleanup. It's a secondary intervention against what is much more predominant, which is this unproblematic appearance that organizes a kind of soft domination that's happening. So this last section deals with Akasagawa's final formulations prior to going into the courtroom and dealing with in part the problem of being reduced back to a kind of unproblematic category of art, which is not supposed to do things in the world, and he has to take on this point by virtue of the way that the legal argument has to go, but I don't want to go through too much of that because I think I'll burn up the rest of our time. But in the end, I mean, he's convicted and he goes through two appeals and in the end they totally let him go. They give him a suspended sentence. They give him back all of his artworks except for the block that's used to make the impressions of the 1000-yen note. But they've occupied, 5 years of his time. And, in the end, I guess the argument in part, it's not a biography of Akasagawa. It's trying to follow out sort of the evolutions of his thinking on this. And as an example of some of the unpredictable and impression places that this art activism goes. It's a different work, I think, and will be a different work to think about sort of the other unforeseen advents of this politicality elsewhere in the 60s in Japan. But the art trial itself was a fraught and strange moment, which apparently had a lot of unexpected attendees. Apparently, Maro Akaji, the later founder of Daidakukan, who's one of Katajudo's actors, is a regular attendee of the trial and some others. This isn't quite the wrap-up that we're looking for, though, I think.
No, this is great. I mean, I think there's so much about the book that is going... There's so much that's going on in the chapters, and there's so much about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And I would love to have had another hour to talk about all of the arguments that you're making about his use of scientific language, the importance of the wrapping of objects, the importance of the notion of moments that emerges as part of the kind of radical practices that a lot of these artists are engaged, or a lot of these practitioners, however we want to label them, in ways that they didn't label themselves, are actually engaging in. There's so much about the book that perhaps, as a way of closing, the best thing to do is to ask you what you would like to close with in the book. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about in these very rich 8 chapters that you'd like to mention and that you'd perhaps like to leave listeners with, especially listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
So I guess one thing I would say is a sort of combined point both about cultural history and about politics, and that is one of my implicit arguments in the book is that what's important to follow if you're interested in questions of politics is often not so much sort of giant masses of people in the streets, but rather asking questions about sort of how political demands get articulated in the first place and how group of schools get formed and how they get their own kind of odd language that seems to make sense. And that's really how I'm reading the artists and why I take their words so very seriously. That it's, if you just look at, you know, people in the street, you're unable to account for, well, how did they get there in the first place? What process led people to feel like, okay, there is this political problem and I must act? And that, I've argued, is a kind of group of skill moment. And so if we can get out of sort of thinking about just, you know, oh, these are artists, and thinking about these are people who are in a fraught moment, who are coming at it from, you know, the perspective that they have at the time, and here's how they come together and formulate their own specific take on things that ends up being quite out in front for what becomes some of the central themes of political activism in the later 60s. Then I think we can better understand sort of the importance of these artists and not necessarily just saddle them with the problems of thinking of art where we stop thinking at that sort of at the borders of the institution, the gallery, the art museum. So that's sort of what I was trying to do, like by taking their work and their words seriously and to try and finish up with this real close reading of that work as a way of identifying how a kind of political language gets created and gets articulated, however weird. And there are some seriously weird moments in it, but you know, that's to be expected. That's how small groups come together in the first place. They develop their own language, and in part that's kind of the point. If they were speaking very easily recognized, obvious things, they wouldn't be saying anything new.
Well, thank you so much, William, for taking the time to talk with me about this book. And I think, as is clear, there's a lot more that we could have talked about. But now that this book is out, and congratulations on the publication of this book, what's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, when I had originally done this, I was thinking of looking at not just art, but a whole series of cultural works in the 1960s. And although that was not a suitable project for a book or a dissertation, the conception wasn't wrong. There's so much interplay across genres, and I've tried to gesture towards that a bit in this book, but I really want to unfold some more of that and to link it more explicitly with some of the moments of activism. I've written a piece on Japan in 1968 in the American Historical Review that looks at sort of the genesis of what I argue is sort of the space for a 68 in Japan. So I'm bringing together these elements and trying to look more generally or more broadly at some of these distinct political moments in the 1960s, and while taking up some of these other forms of cultural production and political production.
Well, best of luck with that work, and thank you again for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you so much, Carla. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.